Access number 30403, Mr. Andre Codin, Reel 10. Now, what about, did you do any work with regard to the sort of floating populations, you know, the stateless persons, the people who'd lost their homes, the people who floated about the country?
Not in Berlin, no.
So, what are the...
When I got over to the zone, to the British zone, yes, we were involved with the
displaced persons.
Displaced persons. Refugees who came, who made their way, who were chucked out of Poland, right, and to date Germany.
Now, hang on.
They
so
made their way to the British
so
zone.
That's later, then, is it?
That's when I came over after 48.
Now,
the British zone.
Anything else happened between 1945 and 1948? Any other incidents that give
well,
us an idea?
Well, nothing remarkable, nothing.
Now, how did you come? You moved, didn't you? Why were you moved? Because you seemed to think there was some sort of mystery behind it.
Yeah, well, I think I got myself a bad name through my big mouth because it was the time when... Well, first of all, I wasn't too happy about the reaction of the British military government, etc., to the Germans in response to the enmity of the Russians. You know.
Now, what do you mean?
Well, all of a sudden, let me illustrate it to you. The military government intelligence where I worked, where I was attached to, also, you know, I told you I was doing the going through the press, etc., etc. And the general attitude was, if a bloke came from the east, and he was a decent, what I would call a decent German, right? Okay, they interviewed him, etc., so what information he could bring, etc., etc., but, you know, you took a bottle of lemonade or water out of the desk, but if there was a bloke over there who came over, of whom we even knew that he had a Nazi background, and he was a bitterly anti-Bolshevik, etc., then the bloody bottle of whiskey was brought out. That was a sort of attitude, you know, and it coloured the whole behaviour towards the Germans. And
so they'd rather they were if they're anti-Soviet, they didn't care if they were Nazis.
That's right.
And you didn't like that.
No, well, obviously I didn't like that.
and you made your view...
Also, around about the same time, later on, with all the trouble in Palestine, and about that time, there was the... when Ernest Bevin, not to mistake him for Bevan, Ernest Bevin then decided with the... to bring back the alleged illegal immigrants into Palestine on that ship, the Exodus, which they then brought back to a North German harbour and forced them off the ships, right? Men, women and children who were partly survivors of the concentration camps, all survivors of ghettos, all from the east, right? And had a they were taken off the ship by force by British soldiers, and I remember the reaction. There were in Berlin, we had quite a detachment of ex-British policemen. They were the so-called public security officers, yeah, the PSOs. They were part of the military government, and they were called out also to help get these thousands of people off the ships and take them into German camps. much to the delight of the Germans. You know, they said, you know, they're the British are knocking the hell out of the Yeats there. And I remember when they came back and got a bit drunk and told each other tales of what they had done, you know. And they took delight in having had a bash at the bloody Yeats.
And obviously, again, you weren't standing for that.
Well, I didn't restrain myself, expressing my disgust and the opinion of the whole thing. And I think that gave me a pretty bad name, and I was sent to the British zone.
So you were transferred. And that was
1948.
And who were you working with in the British zone?
Well, I was kicked out of the field security altogether, and I was I became part of the special investigation branch of the military police. It's stationed in Düsseldorf, and I stayed there for another 4 years.
Now, can you explain what was the role of the special investigation branch?
Well, it's like the CID of the police, you know, the criminal cases, black market. By British soldiers, by German civilians, etc. Then sexual cases, alleged rapes. There wasn't a week when I didn't have to go out and investigate a so-called alleged rape. You know, when a young German lady didn't know when to say stop, or not convincingly enough. And she came home and decided, well, this was rape.
And who was she accused? Was this British?
British soldiers, yeah.
Now, how did you investigate those? They're always difficult to investigate.
Oh,
the
yes, very difficult. We first of all took a statement and collected the knickers of the complainant, right? Asked for witnesses. Tried to find witnesses from the complainant, you know, if she could quote witnesses, etc. Took statements from them, and then we made our way trying to trace the British soldiers. Sometimes they were pointed out to us on identification parades. No, sometimes we found them by just making inquiries in the units stationed nearby, and you always found somebody who said, oh yeah, I think a jock over there, I think he had a go, and you know, and you took the bloke, interrogated him, and sometimes he admitted it, and very often they admitted it, said, no, we were just having fun, etc., you know, and then she was all for it. And so.
And would they come to trial?
Yes, what happened, our report was then filed with the APM, with the Assistant Provost Marshal. And it was there that it was decided if a court-martial was going to be set up, right? And if a court-martial occurred, then I had to come along and give my evidence about taking the statement, etc., etc., right?
And was there a high conviction rate, or?
Well, yes. Usually, only the sort of bona fide cases came to a court-martial. And you could expect that if there was a court-martial, the bloke would get detention or detention and the dishonourable discharge.
What about the black market? How do you? What was the scale of the black market in Düsseldorf?
Oh, it was very large. It involved petrol, army foodstuff, right? Rubber tires. You just think, whatever, you know, a squad he could flog to get himself some German currency.
And how would you investigate it?
Well, we in most cases it was denunciation by Germans of their fellow Germans, and we found the goods in house searches, right? And that was the evidence. And I remember a very unpleasant week when there was a case of there were trades from the Ruhr area where the coal mines were going up to north to Hamburg and whatnot, right? And we got information that the trains halted in various places where they were not supposed to halt, under the guise of replenishing their water supply and whatnot, and the halts were used for taking tons of coal off the wagons to waiting cars, horse carts and whatnot, of German black marketeers with the coal, right? And I spent several days sleeping on these trains and keeping an eye and seeing, you know, trying to find some lead or who the blokes were behind it.
And did you?
Well, we did pick up one or two blokes who hadn't been warned in time, and they were waiting with horse carts at a certain place where the train stopped, and they couldn't give an explanation why they were bloody waiting in the middle of the night in the wild, you know, with an empty cart. So one and one made two. And
did you have many cases involving British soldiers of black market?
Oh, yes.
So what were they up to?
Well, they were just, you know, flogging petrol. There was one, they were siphoning off petrol for the lorries and flogging it. And also, some of it, it may have been a cook or something, and he got his hand on a load of tea and coffee and cigarettes and so, or a nuffy bloke who was flogging cigarettes, you know. That sort of thing, you know.
Any other, any murders you had to investigate? I presume there were some.
There was one very famous accident, not accident, but incident, when a British soldier of the Royal Scots Fusiliers. He was standing on guard in front of a barracks in Mulheim, a place called Mulheim, and the you know where the British soldiers were stationed, and he was on guard, and a German policeman had left duty and he was cycling home, and this bloke shot him in the neck.
Why?
Well, that's exactly. Now, his story, which I believed and later was able to prove, was that he was just playing about. He had just lifted his rifle and aimed at the bloke, and he didn't intend to fire it. He wasn't aware that the rifle was loaded, that he had loaded the bolt pulled the bolt, and he just happened to press the trigger, and there was a great big court martial, because the German press took it. It was in the 1950s, right? You know, and the German press took it up, etc. And they made a big song and dance about it. And what was his name? Fusilier Lindsay. a Scottish cleric, and it was a quite a lengthy court martial. The British press was there. That's when I got a first look at what the British press was, because I was there as a witness because I had been taking statements, a lot of statements which that were then produced in the court martial, and you had to sort of appear there. And there was one bloke from the Daily Express who tried to get me pissed, right? And because we were in a hotel there, and he tried to get me pissed in the bar because trying to get some information or something. And I got wise to that immediately, and I told the German barman in German. I said, "Look, when he says drink, because he ordered the drinks at the bar, you know, and there's a German drink called what the hell is it called? Scheinheger. It's like a gin, right?" And he had a bottle of Steinegger on the bar there, that, and he always told the barman, fill up. And I told the barman in German, "Look, mine you do with water, because it looks like water, Steinegger, you know, like a gin." And he said, "Yeah, okay." And he was filling mine with water. And I was getting him pissed because I said, I knocked it back and I said, "Well, what about?" You know, so the barman filled them up again. But him with Steinegger, me with bloody water. So he got pissed as hell. And what happened then was that really made me always distrust reporters. Because what happened, we were going to, the whole court martial was going with the presiding judge advocate, and the officers, because there's a judge advocate there and a couple of officers, right? We're going down there to the place where it happened. We're going to take an inspecty, you know, like with Diana, they're going now down to Paris. That was going to be the next morning. And we got into the bus, and I looked round, and Jack wasn't there. So I asked one of the other journalists, I said, "Where's Jack?" "Oh," he said, "he can't bloody look out of his eyes. He's as pissed as hell. He's got a hell of a hangover. He can't stand straight." So I said, "All right." And we went there then, and then came back. And then a couple of days later, I looked through the British papers that we got, and there was an article by bloody Jack about the visit of the court martial to the thing. And when I saw Jack then, I said, "Jack, have you got a double?" I said, who wrote that article there?" "Oh," he said, "oh well, that's it." he just rendered that article that was published under his name. He wasn't there at all. He got all the details from, you know, from his mates, from the colleagues. So I said, I'll never believe again anything I read from a journalist that appears under his name.
Now, what about, was the Scottish chap, Lindsay, was he found guilty or not guilty?
I remember that he was found negligent, not with intent to what you call it, because what I got, I got evidence from his unit that every target practice he was a lousy shot, and how he could aim at a distance of about 200 yards and hit a bloke in the neck, right, having aimed at him like that was inconceivable. But he was discharged dishonorably. He got detention for being negligent, the use of weapons whilst on duty, etc., you know, but not for murder.
Any other murders? I mean, no soldiers killing.
No, there were. You can't call them murders. There were whenever there was a fatal accident, right, involving British soldiers, you went out. But these were deaths, but not murders. They were.
So they're accidental deaths.
Accidental death, you know, the.
So what kind of thing would happen?
Reckless driving, and that sort of thing. You had that all the time. Because the blokes used to, you know, they had no speed limit. They didn't take any notice of speed limits, etc. You know, there were lots of accidental death due to negligence.
Any big robberies? You know, I mean, because you know, the worst. I mean, soldiers can carry out serious robberies. Not that you were aware of. How did you get on with the other members of the Special Investigation Branch?
All right, very good. There's okay.
How many were there?
Okay, it's a small unit. I'll show you a picture of them. Yeah?
Well, no, they can't see it.
No, I'll show it to you so that you get an idea. That one captain, one lieutenant, one sergeant major, and the rest, there was a handful of sergeants.
And you all got on, you all worked together well as a team?
Oh, yes, yeah. There was one incident, which is, I think I mentioned it to you, my father didn't leave me any money, but he left me his rotten temper. And I did react rather violently to a remark, a stupid anti-Semitic remark that one of the sergeants made.
Now, when was this?
Pardon?
This was in 1948-52.
That was right at the beginning when I started.
I mean... We're talking about in 1948-52.
Yeah, that was at the beginning when I joined the Special Investigation Branch.
So what happened? You haven't. I don't think we recorded that.
No. Well, I had a few drinks. I was sitting in the bar, and blokes were behind me, and I heard this was just a short while after the. The story with the Exodus immigrants and that were brought back to the British Isles, and I heard there was Bill letting off. He said, "You know what I would do? I'd take the bloody ships out in the middle of the Atlantic and I'd scuttle the bloody lot." Right? And you know, this to me was tantamount to a remark that a German Nazi would make about the inmates of a ghetto or something, you know, set them alight or, you know, blow them up, etc. And I spontaneously had a bottle of beer in my hand. And I turned round on the swivel bar chair and I struck him on the head. He had a half a dozen stitches on it. The captain kept it quiet, you know. He said, "Don't let's make a big song and dance about it." And he himself, he became my best friend. And he insisted that I became his best man when he married a German girl, which I had cleared, because British soldiers were not allowed to marry Germans then unless the family of that bride or prospective bride was investigated about their political past, etc. And I had cleared her, although her family, they were not, when I say they were Nazis, but they had no official position, you know. They were sort of typically ingrained Nazis, but I cleared her.
So
he married her, and he insisted that I became his best man, which I refused at first, and he badgered me week after week. So I said, "All right, then, I'll become your best man," and I became his best man.
So
and then about three or four months later, we were driving out, coincidentally, on a job together, and I was driving the Jeep and on the autobahn on the road to Cologne, and he said, "Andy," he said, there was an autobahn lay-by, he said, "Andy, pull in there, I got something to tell you." And I said, "Well, what is it, tell me." He said, no, pull in. So I pulled in. He said, "Well, you remember the wedding, because what he had, you have an army wedding, and then he had a wedding in the church, in the local church in Düsseldorf. And I was there too, obviously." And, he said, "Well, you remember the wedding there, huh?" He said, "Well, you remember the priest, yeah?" So I said, yeah, I'd spoken to the priest too. And he said, "Well, I didn't tell you that then, because I was afraid the way you would react." So he said, "Well, come out with it, what is it?" So he said, "Well, he wanted the organist to play Mendelssohn's Wedding March. And the priest rejected it. He said he won't have a Jew's music played in his church." Now, Mendelssohn was converted, he had converted to Christianity. But this priest was a real racist anti-Semite. He wouldn't have his music played in his church. And he had to pick another music. And so he picked, they played Wagner. And he told me, "I didn't want to tell you then, because I was afraid what how you would react." And I then said to him, "Well, I'll tell you what, Bill, I'm thinking it over, and what you just told me and the way you told me," I said, "I'm glad you told me." I said, "Not because of the priest, but that you understand, because what happened after I had this set to with him and injured him, we had a lot of talk, and we talked a lot, and I saw that he only spoke out of stupidity, you know, and not of evil." And I said, "It proved to me that all the many hours that I spent talking to you were not in vain." So that was an incident that I always remember. Well, I'll show you later the picture.